Okay, Boker Tov, gentlemen. This morning, I have the schud, you have the schud of hosting Rav Miller. Rav Miller, in my BMT experience, I had a schud of learning with him for 2 years, my Shana Aleph and Shana Bet. Most of the Rabbanim who went through the YU Kolel here in the Grus had opportunities to learn with Rav Miller as well. He's the head of the Kolel, and a tremendous force and inspiration for the Rabbanim that you know, both here in Chutz La'aretz. We've asked him to come speak, not just because it's always good to hear Rav Miller, and last year he had an opportunity to come and spoke to the boys, and the gentleman took it in a very positive manner, but also because of Yom Yerushalayim. And to connect the two, we've invited Rav Miller to speak to us, and Bechavod.
Start off with an unusual question. How many of you are 17 years old? 18 years old? 19 years old? 20 years old? Okay. I'd like to talk to you about a time when I was 20 years old. It's not that much older than most of you are currently. And the year was 1967. Because I didn't come for a year to Israel after high school. So at 20 years old, I was already a junior in college, a junior in YU. In May, one's taking one's exams, one's taking one's finals. And something happened, and I'd like to talk to you about it, not as a hero, I don't view myself in any way in that respect, but as an eyewitness. And I'd like you to put yourself in my shoes and think that had you been born some 40 years earlier, you probably would have made the same decisions that I did, and that you would have had the schut of experiencing that which Kadosh Baruch Hu was mezakeh me that I was able to experience. I'd like to speak to you about some of the lessons also that I think that one can learn from one's experiences. In May of 1967, Israel was a very, very small country. To try and describe how small it is, if you went from Tel Aviv to Yerushalayim, the highway was one lane going in each direction, because on either side of the highway was Jordan. It wasn't as though it was a small road, because they didn't have money to widen it, but simply they couldn't widen it because there were borders on both sides. Those of you who visited Shalavim, Shalavim was the border. On the side of Shalavim, that's where the Jordanian soldiers were stationed. There is a Rav who lives in the Old City. His name is Rav Nachman Kahana. He has a young Israel in the Muslim quarter. He told us, and I think he was really serious, that once he was stuck on the Jerusalem-Tel Aviv highway, and he looked through the trees on the side, and he saw that there was an empty road on the other side of the trees. So he took his car and drove off of the main road and onto that road, because it looked like it was going in the right direction, and he was driving. It was a beautiful road surrounded by trees, and he kept driving and driving, couldn't figure out where he was, because he was driving 10, 15 minutes according to that pace, he should have already been at least at the airport, maybe close to Tel Aviv, and he's just driving and driving, and all of a sudden a soldier stops him and says, "What are you doing on this road?" He said, "There was a traffic jam on the main road, and I saw this road." So the soldier says, this is an army road. So he says, "What do you mean it's an army road?" He said, "This is a road which goes in a circle. It's just one big circle, that if the Jordanians were to begin to attack and were to get with their tanks on this road, they would keep going around in a circle until they figured out where they were, but that time we'd be able to set up defenses." That's how small the country was. Maybe that it was just this, like this little box. And there were some, I think, 2.5 million people in the country at that time. There were 80 million Arabs surrounding Israel. And come Russia, an individual got up and decided it's time now to push the Jews into the sea. His name was Nasser. He was the prime minister, president of Egypt. And he got all of the countries that border around Israel to unite under him. They called it the United Arab Republic. Lebanon and Syria and Jordan and Iraq and Iran and of course Egypt. And you had this big United Arab Republic that decided to push the Jews into the sea. So they tested the water. How do you test the water? Let's see if we can do something, whether the world will react. So there was a... To get to Eilat, you had to go through a certain area that was very, very a thin body of water. It's called the Straits of Tiran. And there was a United Nations force at that point to keep everything open, that people would be able to travel back and forth. They told the United Nations, go away, leave this spot. United Nations packed up their bags and left, and the Egyptian army took over the Straits of Tiran and put a block on Eilat. No boat was able to get to Eilat. And the world was quiet. They didn't say a word. Okay, you tested the water, you see it works. So the next thing was, they said, we are going to invade Israel. And the world was quiet. This is 25 years after the Shoah. 25 years after the Shoah, and the world was just totally quiet. No one said anything. And I'm sitting in New York, and watching TV, like any good American citizen watches TV. And on the news, you see every night, they show you pictures of the Egyptian soldiers and Jordanian soldiers and the Syrian soldiers marching, going through their exercises. And then they show you comparisons. How many tanks do the Arabs have? How many tanks do the Israelis have? How many soldiers do the Arab have? How many soldiers does Israel have? How many planes do the Arabs have? How many planes does Israel have? So let's say they say, and they have a little picture of a tank, and they say, this represents 100 tanks. So you see on the side of the Arabs, some 25 tanks, and on the side of Israel, you see 2 tanks. You see, when it comes to soldiers, you see over here, like these 15 million soldiers, you know, and over here you see, like, you know, where it's 250,000 soldiers. Over here you see like 10 planes. Each of these planes represents 100 planes. And here you see a half of a plane. 50 planes. and you see this and you're saying, like, you know, like, what's going to be? And so there were people who were studying in Israel, Americans who were studying in Israel, not that many, and many of them left. They just left. In other words, they either went home to America, or they went to Europe for the meantime, to go to Switzerland or to go to a yeshiva in England where they'd be able to learn peacefully. And the Israelis called up their reserves. Now, at that time, calling up the reserves meant that every male between the age of 18 and 55 or 60 was called into the army. That if you walked on the streets at that time in Israel, you didn't see a man. You saw women, children, and elderly. That's what was. My current wife, who at that time was in high school, she delivered mail. And her brother, who was not able to be in the army because of a physical disability, so he drove a bus. Namely, that simply there were, everyone simply did something, and then the kibbutzim, who, you know, if you understand that there were no men on the kibbutzim, there's no foreign labor, so they sent out a call for help to America. They said, American Jews, come and help us. We have fruits that are in the trees. They have to be harvested. We have livestock. They have to be fed. There's no one to take care of the kibbutzim. So I have this article. This is from the New York Times, May 31st, 1967. 38 U.S. Jews off to Israel to help. 38 U.S. Jews off to Israel to help. Right? One of them, his name was David Miller, and we were going to save Israel. Right? 38 of us. 38 of us. That's unfortunately, everyone has what to do in America, and so people gave money. In other words, they had a lot of a lot. I'm sorry, of senior. ministers who came to America to collect money. When I came to just going to help, unfortunately, there weren't all that many who decided to take that step. Of the 38 American Jews who went to help, so about 20 of us were from YU and Stern. There were not only men, there were also women. And the others were from different places around the country. Some nurses came, and some individuals who, in other words, who were serious about wanting to help. And it was a strange decision to take, because one was going into a situation from which people were running away. Namely, that the people my age, the Americans my age who were in Israel, were no longer in Israel, most of them. Most of them had already left. And so I turned to my parents, and even though I was 20, I guess I could make my own decisions. I didn't want to do something that would upset them. And I said, is it okay with you if I go to Israel to help out? I didn't know where they would send me. I just wanted to try and help out. So they told me that, you know, we have four children. We have two boys and two girls. You have a brother who's 2 years younger than you. He's learning in Karen Biavna. He wrote to us he would like to remain, even though many of his friends left, and we gave him permission to remain. If you go, that means that all of our sons, all two of you, will be in Israel, and you're our sons. And it really would make things very, very difficult for us to know that we have two sons who are in an area that the Arabs are trying to wipe off the map, and according to all of the statistics, they would have a very good chance of doing it. At one point I thought that if the 80 million Arabs would simply lack arms and begin to walk towards Israel, they would really push all the Jews in Israel into the sea without firing a shot, just by 80 million people walking over the land. And so they said that, you know, they'd rather I wouldn't go. So I said something to them that, looking back on it, was very chutzpahdik, but I felt it was true. And I said, you know, this is what you educated us to do, or to want to do, that you sent us to day school, and you always spoke about Israel as being something very, very important, something that you hold close to your hearts. And isn't this what I should be doing, as according to your education, according to the way you educated me? So we lived in a two-story house. Whenever my parents wanted to talk alone, they went upstairs. So they said, we want to go upstairs. So they went upstairs, and then they came down, and I saw that there were tears in their eyes, and they said, you're right, this is what we educated you. We can't stop you from going. We just have one request of you. I still had, at that time, four grandparents who were alive. They asked me just not to tell my grandparents, not to say goodbye to my grandparents, because they felt that it would not be understood and it would cause them tremendous agmas nefesh. That's all they asked. Okay, but they didn't tell me not to say goodbye to my Rebbe. So I was studying at that time in Rav Soloveitchik Shir, and so I went to Rav Soloveitchik. This was on a Thursday, and I remember, you know, after Shir going to him and saying that I plan to go to Israel to help out. So he began to cry. I said, Rebbe, why are you crying? I was a student. I was like one of many students. He said, I'm not crying for you, but I have one son. And my son is in Israel. And he's my only son. And I would just ask you that if you see him, tell him that I love him. And that was his goodbye, which made me feel very, very wonderful. Here I caused my parents to cry. I caused my Rebbe to cry. And, you know, maybe I should rethink this. But I felt very, very strongly that this is what I should be doing. And so on Sunday, June 5th, that was a few days after this article was in the New York Times on 38 U.S. Jews off to Israel to help, that's when the plane was scheduled to leave. And we left. And while we were in the air, the Six-Day War broke out. On Monday, June 6th, that's when the war broke out. And the plane landed in Paris, At that time, planes didn't fly directly from America to Israel. The plane had to land in Paris to refuel. And my French wasn't all that great. I had studied in high school. But, you know, so we tried to listen to the radio to hear what was going on. And for those of you who studied about the Six-Day War, at that time, at the beginning of the war, the Arabs were already proclaiming victory. They were already telling how they were bombing Tel Aviv. And from the Israeli side, there was a total blackout on news. They didn't say anything. They didn't say what was going on. So we pulled out our Tehillim and began saying, Tehillim, what are you going to do? You're flying. And the war broke out, and Israel is losing. Israel is being defeated. They're really being pushed into the sea. And then after about 6 or 7 hours that we were on the ground in Paris, and you have to understand, at that time, people didn't call. You know, we didn't call America to find out what was going on. We had no numbers in Israel. All we knew was what was being announced in French on the radio. The plane said that if you want to stay here, you can stay here, but we're continuing. So we got back on the plane. The plane took off, and it didn't get to Israel. We landed in Athens. We didn't know what was going on. Why in the world are we in Athens? Until a few hours later, actually about 10 hours later, we were in Athens for about 10 hours, we got back on the plane, and there were no seats on the plane. All the seats were taken off the plane, and all the floor was just full of grease. That it appears that they needed ammunition, so they took, this is an El Al plane, they took all the seats off the plane, they filled the plane with ammunition, they flew it to Israel, and then flew it back to take us to Israel, but didn't have a chance to put the seats back in. It was an interesting flight. It's not that far from Athens to Israel. And we arrived in the middle of the night. You look out the window and you didn't see anything. There was a total blackout in Israel, a total blackout in the airport. It was only afterwards I tried to figure out how the plane landed. But at that time, that wasn't exactly my concern, how the plane landed without any lights at all, without any runways, without anything. But the plane landed and taxied to a certain place. And then we took our luggage off the plane. You know, you know, you go and you open that thing and it comes down and we push someone up into it and we took down the luggage and we're standing there with our bags and a bus comes and says, okay, in other words, everyone on the bus with your, and the bus also didn't have any lights, everyone on the bus, and then they said, anyone who's religious, you have two options. You can either go to Kibbutz Yavne or to Chafetz Chaim. So the fellow next to me, who you may know, may have spoken here even, his name is Benji Levine. He's the grandson of Rabbi Aryeh Levine. Okay, should ask him to come to speak. He can also tell you the same story. He went to Chafetz Chaim. And he said, come with me, you know, David, come with me to Chafetz Chaim. It's, you know, it's frumer. So I said, it's very nice, but I have a brother in Kerem B'Yavne, and this is going to Kibbutz Yavne. They can't be that far from one another. And I hadn't seen my brother for over a year. And so I'll go. I'd rather go to see my brother. So I went alone to Kibbutz Yavne. He went to Chafetz Chaim. And the first thing that we had to do when we got to the kibbutz, it was still nighttime, they said, okay, we'll walk with you. Again, everything is totally dark. We'll walk with you. This is where you're going to stay. But before you go to sleep, you have to dig yourself a trench. You have to dig a trench into the ground that if there's an air raid siren, you just jump out of bed and you fall into this trench. So the trench has to be deep enough that you'll go in the ground, that, you know, if there's any air raid, that you'll be safe in this trench. I also couldn't figure out exactly how I was going to be safe in a trench, but you don't ask questions. So we dug trenches for ourselves. Everyone had to dig their own trench. And then it was already morning, so we didn't get very much sleep. And they said, okay, now you have to go to work. And so we were sent out to work, and that's what we came to do. And when we came back for lunch, and this is already Wednesday, Kafchet Iyar, Tavshin, Kaf Zayin, when we came back from lunch, the radio was on. And on the radio we heard, Har Habayit B'yadenu, Mata Gur described the fact that we had already heard that Israel, Baruch Hashem, had destroyed the Arab air forces, that the Arabs were still shelling Israel in terms of Yerushalayim, and so they decided to conquer the old city. And Har Habayit B'yadenu, and then we heard Rav Goren blow the shofar at the Kotel. So that was the first thing that we heard on Wednesday afternoon. And then without really, and you have to understand, this is a kibbutz. On a kibbutz, there aren't rabbis. On a kibbutz, there were everyone who thinks they're rabbis. And so, but it was sort of everyone without thinking, or maybe from one's heart, we all went to the shul, and we said Hallel with a bracha over this nice nigla that here we thought we were coming, I wouldn't say necessarily to die, but at least to maybe 50-50. And here, not only is there a victory, but Harabayis biyadeinu. And then the next day we hear Beit Lechem biyadeinu, and Chevron biyadeinu, and all, in other words, and Shechem biyadeinu, and Kever Yosef biyadeinu. It was something that was sort of out of this world. It was something that was not, that was Hayinu Kecholmim. You know, it's hard to picture. And you're coming into this little country which is being threatened with total destruction. When you're on the way, you hear that it's being destroyed. For some strange reason, you're being pulled b'cholzot, even though it's being destroyed, to continue on your path. That's what you said you were going to do. You're going to try and help out as much as you can. And then HaKadosh Baruch Hu just goes ahead, and not only does he save you from Mavet to Chayim, but he gives you gifts that you never dreamed of having. There was the time that was spent, of course, on the kibbutz was spent working in every area that one works in a kibbutz. I learned what livestock smell like, what they feel like, and how to put a pitchfork into a bale of hay and lift it so that it goes onto a truck. That was after a few times that it fell on my head. But when one learned how to do all sorts of things, but the what I remember is not so much putting hay onto a truck, but rather Shavuot of that year. Today is Kaf Zayin Iyar, tomorrow Kaf Chet Iyar, next week, Friday, is Shavuot. So a week after the Kotel, the Har Habayit, was conquered, that's the first day that they opened it up to the public. Shavuot, Chag HaShavuot, they said they're going to open it up to the public. In the meantime, what had happened was that someone, turns out later that was Rav Gorin, had given an order to tear down the entire Shchunat HaMugrabim. There was a whole Arab neighborhood that had been built leaning on the Kotel. And he just tore down the entire neighborhood to have what's called now the plaza. At that time it was not a plaza, it was a neighborhood. And afterwards, of course, there was a commission of inquiry who gave the order, but it was done. So that area was sort of bulldozed away, and that's where people were told they can go on Chag HaShavuot. Now, just to give you a sense of what that meant to every Jew who was living in Eretz Yisrael, I had been in Eretz Yisrael previously. My parents had taken me in 1961, during the summer. I was already bar mitzvah, and that was like the bar mitzvah gift that they took the family to Eretz Yisrael. And we wanted to see the Kotel. But you couldn't see the Kotel. There was no way of seeing the Kotel. But if you were able to go up to Har Tzion, and you didn't have compunctions about going on the roof of a church, so there is a church there, an abbey, the Dominican abbey, and if you walk up on the roof of the abbey, next to the dome of the abbey, then you could see from there the dome of Har Habayit. You could see from there the mosque on Har Habayit, and they'll tell you, although you can't see it, right in front of it, that's where the Kotel is. So on Tisha B'Av, in 1961, we saw maybe what, you know, we couldn't see the Kotel, but we knew approximately where it was. That was the closest that you could get. The closest that you could get to the Kotel was on top of that abbey on Har Tzion, that for 19 years was the closest you can get. For people who had issues about climbing on top of a church, so on Rehov Strauss, there's a very tall building, at least at that time it was a tall building, called the Histadrut building, on the corner of Rehov Strauss, where you go down to Mea Shearim. And so people would climb up to the roof of that building, and you could see the dome of the mosque. Those were the two places that people would go if they wanted to have a sense of coming somewhat close to the Kotel. Either one of those two areas you could see from. And here, the Kotel is being opened up that people will be able actually to daven at the Kotel. And so the entire yeshiva, like of Keren B'Yavne, came to Yerushalayim, like every yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael came to Yerushalayim for Shavuot. And they put up the students somewhere, or people just found places. We had some friends who put us up on the floor, and they and we davened in Heichal Shlomo for Shacharis and Kriyas HaTorah and Megillas Rus, and then we danced from Heichal Shlomo to the Kotel to David Musaf. That's pretty much what everyone did. Now, to get to the Kotel at that time, there was a one-way street. What you did was you danced down Rehov, King George, until you get to an area which is close to what now is the Inbal Hotel. And there, from that point, there was a road that was made for a pope. There was a pope who visited Israel. I seem to recall it was 1963. Rabbi Rakefet says it was 1966. But in any case, a pope visited Israel, and they made a pathway for the pope to be able to walk. I mean, how would you get from Israel to Jordan? The old city was Jordan. The pope wanted to visit his Christian people in Jordan. So they made a road that went down into the valley of Gei Ben Hinnom and then up to Har Tzion, and the pope walked on that road. And even though that road, since the pope had been there, was no man's land, but now it was going to be used for hundreds of thousands of people to be able to get to the Kotel. So everyone was pushed towards that road. You waited your turn, and you walked up that road. That road took you to Har Tzion, and you walked around Har Tzion till you got to Shaar HaAshpot. You walked through Shaar HaAshpot, and then through some ruins of old Arab homes, and then there was this whole area that had been bulldozed that was full of rubble and full of dust and dirt, and there you saw the Kotel, and you were allowed to daven and then continue so that everyone else will be able to keep going, and when continuing, you didn't go back the same way. It was all one way. You continued out up the Arab Shuk, out of Shaar Yafo. You couldn't go in Shaar Yafo. You had to go in through Shaar HaAshpot and out through Shaar Yafo. And everyone, again, hundreds of thousands of Jews danced the entire way. There were on top of the wall of the old city, there were our soldiers, and of course the flag, and everyone was just dancing and singing the entire way to get to the Kotel. At the Kotel, it was bedlam in terms of, if you think now, when you have X number of minyanim, so at that time, when everyone was trying to touch the Kotel, or to look at the Kotel, and to daven, and to sing, and to dance, that was Shavuot in June of 1967, in Sivan of Tavshin Kaf Zayin, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu enabled me to be an eyewitness and sort of to give you, which is really why I'm speaking to you, a sense of what was. And just to make a long story short, I continued to remain in the kibbutz until the miluim came back, until the reserves came back, and then really I was not made to be a kibbutz worker. That was not my that I don't think was what the Kadosh Baruch Hu wanted of me, and returned to America, finished my studies, and came back on Aliyah. Why am I telling this to you? Firstly, to understand what happened, to understand the nature of the Nes Nigla that HaKadosh Baruch Hu did for Klal Yisrael on the plane of Mimavet Lechayim and on the plane of a tremendous gift that he gave us. I don't know how many of you saw this morning's paper. The headline of the New York Times this morning is 4 individuals arrested for trying to bomb the Riverdale Jewish Center. Many of you may have davened there. That there were 4 individuals who decided that they were going to destroy a shul, 2 shuls, one Reform and one Orthodox in Riverdale, and they were also going to shoot down some American airplanes to top it off. And these people were followed for a year. They were given dummy bombs, and when they planted the bombs last night, that's when they were arrested. Now, I'm not the rabbi of the Riverdale Jewish Center. Rabbi Yonatan Rosenblatt, who is our student, is a rabbi of the center. Were he to ask me, I would tell him that tomorrow they should have a Sudat Mitzvah in the shul, because had they succeeded in their plan, and they were, in other words, had they're not... person who was giving them their ammunition and their bombs, had he not been an informant, they would have succeeded in their plan. Then, chas v'shalom, hundreds of Jews would have been killed. The entire shul would have been destroyed. The bombs were planted in cars sitting around the shul. You make a sudas mitzvah. That's what Jews do. In other words, they wouldn't forget about Yom Yerushalayim. Nothing to do with Yom Yerushalayim. It would be their Purim Katan. That's the Psak Halacha, that when a miracle occurs and when a tragedy is averted, then one should keep that day. And if they were to have a vote in the Riverdale Jewish Center that for generations they were to keep that day to remember that HaKadosh Baruch Hu saved them from being blown into smithereens, then such a vote would have a halachic effect on their children and grandchildren until Yemot HaMashiach, that they would keep that day. Whatever special tefillah they would say, and whatever suda they would have, they would have. And you're talking over here in the Riverdale Jewish Center with a dummy bomb. Think, had they been real bombs, and they just wouldn't have gone off. And that's what happened in Eretz Yisrael. And it's not one shul, but an entire Jewish population. And not just a Jewish population, but Eretz Yisrael. And this is 25 years after the Shoah. And the world said nothing. The world just wouldn't have cared one iota had Israel ceased to exist. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us Eretz Yisrael, and gave us the Eretz Yisrael that you see nowadays. That's point number one. Just to have Hakaras HaTov to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to feel the Hakaras HaTov. But secondly, I'd like to speak to you about something else. There was a pasuk in the beginning of last week's parasha, in Bechukosai Teilechu, V'yes Mitzvosai Tishmeru, V'asisem Osam. The pasuk has three parts. In Bechukosai Teilechu, you know what Rashi says, Tiyu Amelim Batorah, learn. Pasuk ends up, V'asisem Osam, you learn and you do mitzvos. What's the middle of the pasuk? Mechukosai Teilechu, V'yes Mitzvosai Tishmeru, V'asisem Osam. What's Es Mitzvosai Tishmeru? What else is there aside from learning and doing mitzvahs? What is this middle part of the pasuk? So there is an Or HaChaim, Or HaChaim HaKadosh, who has 42 explanations of those three words. I think it's one of the longest Or HaChaims in Chumash. And Yerush Yeshiva brought me a copy of the Or HaChaim, so I won't go through all 42. I won't even go through 20. I just want to go through one line. So if you were to move in the Or HaChaim to explanation number 14. In the middle over there, he says, what does Tishmeru mean? Tishmeru Perush. Shetiyu machakim otam matai yovau liyetchem la'asotam. The Or HaChaim says that the concept of Shmira doesn't only mean to keep, to watch. Shmira means, like by Yaakov Avinu, that when he saw, when Yosef told him of his dreams, it says, Va'aviv Shamar et hadavar. What does it mean? It doesn't mean that he watched over Yosef's dreams and put them into his safe with lock and key. Vaviv shamar et hadavar means he waited in anticipation for when they would be fulfilled. In Bechukosai Teilechu, if you study the Torah, v'yes mitzvosai tishmeru, and you look forward to doing mitzvos, you look for opportunities to do mitzvos. You think, when will I have the opportunity, when will I have the chance to do such a mitzvah? You treat mitzvahs with a sense of ga'aguim, a sense of yearning. You all know the story of Rabbi Akiva, that when he was being tortured at the end of his life by the Romans, and his students said, Rabbi, how do you feel? And he responded to them, Kol Yamai, my entire lifetime I was waiting until I would be able to perform this mitzvah of dying al kiddush Hashem. Namely, that he viewed his life as opportunity to do mitzvos. There were opportunities to teach Torah. There were opportunities to do chesed. We know Rabbi Akiva. He visited the sick. He took care of his students. And there was an opportunity that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave him to be mekayim the mitzvah of nikdashti besoch b'nei Yisrael, of being moser nefesh. He viewed that as an opportunity. And the pasuk says, this is how we should view mitzvos. We should view mitzvos as opportunities. We should view mitzvos as something to look forward to. Every one of us is given in life different opportunities. The difference between person A and person B is who was thinking of this all his lifetime as an opportunity, and then who would grab the opportunity, as opposed to someone who didn't view his life in that manner. He viewed his life as a series of events, right? Halachta mitikeri. You know, it's just a lot of chance events. He didn't view what HaKadosh Baruch Hu was giving him as putting choices before him, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was waiting to see how he's going to relate to those choices. All of us are educated in certain manners. The question is, how seriously do we take our education? How seriously do we take that which we are told that we maybe should do under certain circumstances? Would we actually do it if push came to shove, if we had that opportunity? There's a very, very frightening Rashi in Chumash. Rashi in Chumash tells us on V'chamushim, Alu B'nei Yisrael Me'eretz Mitzrayim, the Chazal understand that B'nai Yisrael, 20% of them left Mitzrayim, 80% of B'nai Yisrael never left Mitzrayim. They died during the Makas HaChoshech. We know they died because they didn't deserve to leave Mitzrayim. What did they do not to deserve to leave Mitzrayim? Were they Oved Avodah Zarah? Were they Megala Arayos? Were they Over Lo Tirtzach? What did they do not to deserve to leave Mitzrayim? So Rashi says, Shelo Ratzu Latzeit Mitzrayim. They had no desire to leave Mitzrayim. That was all. They didn't do any Averos. Just when the opportunity came to leave Mitzrayim, they just weren't interested. They didn't view it as an opportunity. They didn't view it as Shamaret HaDavar. They didn't view it as something that they had yearned to do. Okay? So, in other words, we can stay in Mitzrayim. Now we have all of these Makos, and, you know, our situation will be better. The Shibud is already finished. Why leave Mitzrayim? That's all. They just didn't want to go. They didn't take advantage of the opportunity that HaKadosh Baruch Hu presented them. And so HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, okay, so if you don't need it, I don't need you either. And only the 20% who said, we have the opportunity, we view it with yearning, we view it with gaguim, only those were the ones who left Mitzrayim. I heard about 2 or 3 years after the Six-Day War, a sikha that was given, actually it was even more than that, it was about 6 or 7 years after the Six-Day War, a sikha that was given by a ram in Alon Shvut, in Gush. And he said that one has to realize that when we conquered, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us the option of conquering the old city, not only did we conquer the Kotel, but we also conquered Har HaBayit. But, as you're aware, Har HaBayit, we returned to the Arabs. We gave it back to them. We gave them back the keys to Har HaBayit. He said, why did that happen? After all, if you think about it, Har HaBayit, that's Mikdash. That's the core of Klal Yisrael. That's where Yitzchak was brought as an Akedah. That's where the Beis HaMikdash was. That's where the Shechina is. The Kotel is what's left of the Binyan HaBayis. But Har HaBayit itself, if you had an opportunity of having Har HaBayit, why in the world would you give it back? So he said that what happened was that if you were to ask a Jew in 1948, 1949, 1950, 1955, 1960, what he yearns for, he would answer, I yearn for the Kotel. Before 48, we used to be able to daven at the Kotel. I yearn to be able to daven at the Kotel. So Kosh Baruch Hu said, okay, you yearn for the Kotel, I'll give you the Kotel. But you're not yearning for Har HaBayit, so there's no reason for me to give it to you. And you'll just give it back to the Arabs. Because in B'chukosai Teilechu, there was a lot of learning, there was Vasi Semosam, there was a lot of kiyum mitzvos, but there was no es mitzvosai tishmeru. There was no yearning for mikdash. There was no yearning for Har HaBayit. The yearning was all for the Kotel. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us that which we yearn for. If we're shomer, if we want something, if we want it seriously enough, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will give us that gift. If it's a gift that we're not interested in, why in the world should HaKadosh Baruch Hu give us a gift that we're not interested in at all? we yearned for Kever Rachel. We yearned for Marat HaMachpelah. We yearned for Kever Yosef. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us that which we yearned for. But that which we don't feel that is really a part of us, that which we don't link into emotionally, there, why should HaKadosh Baruch Hu at all give it to us? I heard that about 35 years ago. It made a very lasting impression. And that's why I'm telling it over to you now. It's no one knows what HaKadosh Baruch Hu's cheshbonos are, but it's something certainly to think about. There's a Gemara in Ksuvos that deals with Tzion. Tzion is Yerushalayim. The Gemara on Daf Ayin Hei Amar Aleph points out as follows. Gemara quotes a pasuk in Tehillim. Ulitzion yeyamar, ish ish yuladba, vehu yechoneneha elyon. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu will say about Tzion that there will be an ish v'ish. There will be two individuals who are born there, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu will bring about a fulfillment of the rebuilding of Tzion. Amar Rav Maisha bar Bered Rav Yoshua ben Levi. Echad hanolad ba, ve'echad hametzape lirosa. That there are two individuals who relate to Tzion. A person can be born in Tzion, he'll be born in Yerushalayim, and he relates to Tzion because it's his home. That's where he was born. And then there is an individual who is metzape lirosa. There is an individual who yearns to see Tzion. Both of these can bring about the rebuilding of Yerushalayim, being born in Tzion and yearning to rebuild Tzion. Here there's a unique challenge that you have that I didn't have. I was born in a generation of Hametzapel Lirota. I was born, there was no Eretz, there was no Medinat Yisrael. I was born before Kum HaMedina. I was born as I grew up, and there was no Kotel to daven at, there was no old city to walk through, there was no Kever Rachel to cry at, there was no Marat HaMachpelah, at which one could feel a closeness with the Avot. None of that existed as I grew up. When I was your age, none of that existed as part of my reality. I was Mitzapel Lirota. I had pictures on my wall of the Kotel. I had pictures on my wall of Kever Rachel and Marat HaMachpelah, but they were dream material. It was not something that was real. And when I speak about myself, I mean my entire generation. That's how we grew up. We grew up hoping that someday this will become a reality. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu heard our dreams and gave us the gift. You're a generation of Echad HaNoladba. You were all born into Yerushalayim. Right? You were all born into Eretz Yisrael as it is currently, three times as big as it had been, or at least twice as big as it had been, and spiritually with all of the ability to come to Eretz Yisrael, to learn in Eretz Yisrael, to many of you may have parents or uncles or aunts who have homes in Yerushalayim. It's part of your, simply part of your existence. It's built into to you. It's much harder, it appears to me, to yearn when you have something. It's much harder to feel that something is missing when you have so much. But that's your challenge. Your challenge is to get to the level of Ushmartem Osam, to yearn for that which we don't yet have, to take that which we have only as a stepping stone to what could be. The Yerushalayim, as we know it, is beautiful. Yerushalayim, as we know it, is very, very special. But it's not where we want to be. It's not what HaKadosh Baruch Hu envisioned that should be. Certainly, there is a level of Shechina in Yerushalayim which one doesn't feel in the Five Towns, in Riverdale. There's a level of Shechina even in Muncie. There's a level of Shechina in Yerushalayim which you feel is part of you. When you feel it when you daven, you feel it when you learn Avira de Eretz Yisrael, you feel the Kedusha of Yerushalayim, but that's not what was meant to be the goal. The goal is the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash. The goal is to relate to HaKadosh Baruch Hu on the highest possible level. The goal is to have a Chuvra Yachtov in which all the Jews will feel a sense of unity in Yerushalayim. That's something to dream about. That's something that we can still want, but we have to want it in order for HaKadosh Baruch Hu to make a decision that he wants to give it to us. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives opportunities. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives gifts. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants to see that there is a shmira, that there is a tzipia. That's the question that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to ask us, Lachar Me'a Ve'esrim, tzipita le'gu'ula. Did you yearn for Geula? Did you have Ga'agu'im? Did you anticipate? Did you look forward towards Geula? Or do you say, no, you know, I had my year in Israel. It was a great time. It was something very special. I made a lot of good friends. I met a lot of interesting people. I have Rebbeim that now I can contact if I have issues when I'm in the States. And basically that's it. And now I'm just going to go ahead and lead my life after having had this nice experience and, you know, become what I had always planned to be, a lawyer, an accountant, maybe a doctor, maybe a teacher, and that's all. In other words, there's nothing in terms of your experience which means that you want to take things one step further, that you want to make a jump, you want to make a leap, that there should be a quantum change in the whole nature of our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, a quantum change in the whole relationship between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the world. That's the Hayinu Kecholmim. That's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is waiting for us to want. You're still young enough to be idealistic. You're still young enough, you have your whole lives ahead of you. You're still young enough to think, well, if I would have been 20 when Rabbi Miller was 20, there would have been 39 people on that plane, or 40 people on that plane, or 41. Probably the whole yeshiva would have gotten on the plane. There would have been 70 people on the plane. I'm sure that probably in that circumstance you would have, because you would have been part of my generation that was mitzapim. We lived a generation of not having, and therefore the yearning was very, very real. The challenge is in your generation. The challenge is now, with whatever we have, to still want to take it one step further, to still want to be moser nefesh for Klal Yisrael, to still view it that you want to be moser nefesh for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That really, I think, is what Yom Yerushalayim is all about. So, Emir Tzashem, I want to give you a Birkas Hedyot, that you should go Mechayel El Chayel, that you should grab the opportunities that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives you, that you should view every challenge as a possibility and potential to be able to grow, and realize that not to take anything for granted on one hand, but also that things can change overnight. Everything can change overnight. But that you should be part of the 20% rather than part of the 80%. That you should be the one who is going to go to Har Sinai rather than the one who's going to say, what do I need it for? And Emir Tzashem, you should go from Yom Yerushalayim into Rosh Chodesh Sivan to Shloshet Yemei Hagbalah to Matan Torah, and then no matter where you are next year, you should always have the sense of the dream of what can be, and Yitzhak Hashem, what in your lifetime will be.
Okay, gentlemen, just to have an opportunity, again, don't have lost opportunities, but we'll take a few questions. It does not have to be on this topic. It can, doesn't have to be. Perhaps there's certain issues that you'd like to ask, an open forum from Gadol B'Torah, like Rav Miller. We'll be glad to take the questions for a few moments. And thereafter, obviously, Rav Norman's going to take over Rav Nepel's Gemara Shir and regular Shirim as planned. Yeah, Adam from Australia.
Have you been on Tahara Bias? And how do you feel about
it? I feel that in Yirtzeh Hashem, when we will be Tahorim, and be able to be up on Har HaBayit, I would love to be up on Har HaBayit. But currently, since most Rishonim are posek, that the Kedush of Har HaBayit is Kitshel HaShaita V'Kitshel HaSed Lava, and we are in the Geder of Tmei Meit, and one is not certain exactly what are the boundaries of Har HaBayit. No one knows for sure where the Evan Shesia was, and then according to the Evan Shesia, where the Aron was, that's how one would draw the boundaries, and since there are all sorts of theories as to where it was, so we have what's called a Safek Karet. I would like to live both in this world and in the future world. I'm not interested in putting myself into a safek karet. And so the answer to your question is no. I have not yet been up on Har HaBayit. But again, when we have the Efer, the Parah Aduma, and we'll be able to, I hope that just as I was one of the first at the Kotel, I'll be able to be one of the first on Har HaBayit as well.
Other questions, starting from this side. Abanim included. Same.
Fine.
So, okay. Yeshua Kor, thanks again.